Lightspeed Venture Partners presents Tomorrow Built Today. You can find details from this episode and more at tbtpodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Tomorrow Built Today, a podcast about technology, popular culture, and the extraordinary people who are transforming both. My name is Alex Tasig, and I'm a partner at Lightspeed in Silicon Valley. Today, I'm in my hometown of San Francisco, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Joey Zwillinger, co-founder and president of Allbirds. Allbirds is a footwear startup that makes some of the world's most comfortable shoes from natural materials. Joey, thanks for taking time to come on the podcast.
Well, I'm humbled to be on the show and with such great people you brought on guests. It's amazing. So thank you for having me.
We're super happy for you to be here. And I'm really excited because I've been a fan, as you know, and wearer of Allbirds since, I think, nearly the beginning. A long time ago, around the time you launched, you were basically sold out and I came and visited you and you gave me some factory rejects.
Those were called Founders Edition.
Founders Edition.
You forget the marketing. That's right.
Well, I treated them very well with lots and lots of love and I still have them. Although I have to admit, I have moved on to some of the newer models. And I think I'm on my fourth or fifth.
Well, we've made some improvements since back then.
Yeah, no, it's been a relatively short time, but things have come a long way. And I'm wearing my dark gray wool loungers right now. These are the shoes I live in, basically.
Love it.
And when people think about Allbirds, what probably comes to mind, you know, is the connection to New Zealand with your co-founder, Tim Brown, his obsession with merino wool, which is kind of what the first product's made of. But the company is so much broader than that. And I was wondering if people knew about your origin story, because I think it's quite unconventional for a company in the footwear space. And so I wanted to start by just talking a little about your own story, in particular, your experience at your last company, Solozyme, because it informs kind of how you guys, I think, have thought about the products here.
Yeah, and Lightspeed was an investor in Solozyme.
That's right.
I would say people raise an eyebrow when they know that I come from a biotech company and then started a shoe company. So I think it's certainly a question worth asking. The whole purpose around Allbirds is about making the environment a better place and using more sensible materials when you're manufacturing consumer products. That's why Tim and I got excited, and I can tell you a bit about the story about that. But I started looking at using business in the private sector to do something positive for the environment probably 10, 15 years ago, and started looking at, from an investment perspective, I was at a company called Industry Ventures, and I was trying to invest in, using the parlance of the time, was clean tech companies, and the model didn't really fit. Industry Ventures wasn't really situated to make investments in kind of high-risk technology companies, but I knew that, and I got advice around that time, maybe a little bit before that, just kind of your general career advice. And I remember it's just really smart thinking around, find a multi-generational problem that you can ride the wave on and make sure that you're passionate about what that problem is and trying to solve it. And for me, kind of growing up in Northern California, it was all about, you know, doing smart things for the environment. And the things we've done for the last 75 years have not been very sensible in terms of utilizing a finite set of resources on this planet. And so I started looking at a bunch of different companies in the Bay Area, and Solozyme was an amazing technology where we engineered microalgae and we programmed it using biotechnology tools to metabolize sugar and produce a high performance product in food, fuel, or chemicals. And I ended up leading the chemicals business. And I'd often find myself in companies trying to sell them a great product, a new collaboration for something that could improve their performance and make their sustainability and their carbon footprint just incredible. And they didn't care. Mm-hmm. And every time I went there, it ended up devolving to a sourcing conversation where it's like, can you just do what I do now and just do it cheaper? Mm-hmm. And I realized through that process that people, you know, the power is with the brands, power is with the consumers ultimately, but the brands need to understand how to speak to them. And going downstream and creating a brand and curating the best and most sustainable products to make amazing products was something that I felt was a big opportunity, and one that was a purpose-driven company that could create something that was a long-lasting brand and something that really resonated, particularly with millennial audiences, because I think a lot of millennials are gravitating to newer, more modern brands that do stand for something broader than making money. And so we found that there was a great opportunity, and shoes is just a dearth of leadership for environmentally responsible manufacturing. And we thought that we could make amazing products because they'd been overlooking, the whole industry had just overlooked these materials for decades. Mm-hmm. So we thought there was this amazing business opportunity and an amazing opportunity to lead. And so there you go. I became a cobbler. That was it.
A cobbler with wool, but yeah. A cobbler nonetheless.
Exactly.
There's so many things I want to dig in on here, but one of them is, you know, you draw this line between sort of the environmental mission at Solozyme, some of the difficulties you had selling that to customers, and how that inspired you to take that same perspective on the world, or the same worldview when you started a shoe company. But what's worked in terms of how you're communicating that sustainability to the consumer? Because it's the kind of thing that I'm sure if you beat someone over the head with it, they're going to get turned off. But yet it's so central to the brand. And like, how do you strike that balance and get that subtlety? And what have you found? Have you found customers really appreciate that aspect of what you guys do?
For the most part. So the way we think about it is we really separate the purpose of our business with the sales techniques of our products. So we make great products. That's it. They're better looking, they're more comfortable, they're priced appropriately. We have great service when we sell you the shoes. The website experience is fantastic. All those things, when you're buying a pair of shoes, is much more important than something like sustainability, which you might buy for an altruistic reason. But really, people, when they're using their wallet to get a product, it's a pragmatic decision. So we really try to separate these two things. And it's really, I think it's summed up really well by, you know, you ask 100 people on the street in San Francisco, you'd probably get 99 people that said they care about the environment. But then they would say that at the exact same time that they're doing something that's probably not the most responsible for what they're doing with their wallet. They're buying a coffee cup for two sips of an espresso and throwing it right out or something, you know, whatever it is, small things. But there's this cognitive dissonance between what people say they care about and with the actions that they do. And so we try to kind of take that equation and change it a little bit. And what we try to do is make great products because they're sustainable, not in spite of it, and not just because of it. So it's not just to make it more sustainable. So the important part for us is that our products stand up because they're amazing. The fact that they happen to be sustainable means that we can then make people feel good about their purchase after they realize that it is sustainable. So we never leave with that from a product messaging. Mm-hmm. And when people get home, they kind of have more of an experience. They open the box, they look at the packaging, they see the website, they get our emails, which are sparse, by the way, so don't worry about signing up for an email account, that we make that experience more comprehensive and we talk about what we're doing. So, and our goal is, you know, everyone should be wearing no shoes if they could for the environment, but that's probably not going to happen. So the next best thing is going to be Allbirds. And if you can make that choice between some other shoe or us, you're doing something really, really good for the planet. And so, you know, that separating that allows us to get further purchases in the future with customers, and it helps spread word of mouth because people like to support a brand that stands for something that's more meaningful than just something simple like comfort or style or whatnot.
Sometimes when consumers come in the door, they're coming in for a different reason than the reason that leads them to repeat purchase. I think most people probably never worn wool on their feet before other than in socks, but they never worn wool shoes. They were presumably buying for comfort or for style or for some reason. But then do you find that once they have the shoes and they start to get the emails, they see the box, they see some of the values the company has, is that when the emotional resonance with sustainability kicks in?
I think that's a big part of it. Yeah, we kind of look at it as a post-purchase halo is the way we would define it. And it's about what happens after and the ripple effect of that. And I think the fact that you can engender more loyalty if there's something that's more meaningful beyond just the performance and value that you get from buying the shoe, there's something special that can happen.
Yeah. I often use Allbirds as an example of when I talk about consumer brands defined digitally that have done well basically out of the gate. From what I understand, it was basically the moment you guys launched, it was a raging success. And I'm not aware that you did a lot of marketing spend in the early days to pump that up. So I wanted to talk about, like, what do you think it was that drove your initial resonance when you guys launched? How much of it did you anticipate? How much of it was intentional? How much of it was just sort of seeing what was going on and doubling down on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way we could have predicted what happened. I mean, we did have a really great start, and there's no doubt about that. And we felt incredibly fortunate at the time. We ran through our first PO, our first purchase order, which was 10,000 shoes in a time that we expected it to take like 3 months. It took us like 2.5 weeks. It was a pretty wild time, and we didn't spend a dollar on marketing, kind of your traditional like performance marketing, Facebook or Google or any of those things. We didn't spend a dollar on that stuff for at least 6 months. And there was no point because we didn't have shoes. So we didn't want to like get pay for people to come to our website, and we couldn't even sell them shoes. So a lot of that was driven by that, because we did want to build that muscle and understand how to reach consumers in a way through advertising that felt like a great discovery process. And I don't see it as a negative thing for people to find our ads. I think it's a great discovery encounter with our brand and something that will delight a customer. So that, I think it's a good thing. We focused on brand. And the way we think about brand is that it's about telling a great story with a great personality that's authentic and matching that with an amazing product that lives up to the promise you kind of set out there, the expectations you set. And so those two things have to happen beautifully and in great harmony, and it has to be done in a way that is differentiated. Mm-hmm. So we focused on doing something totally different. No one had worn wool on their feet before, so it's a little surprising. So that surprise element made it a little bit newsworthy. The three things we spent on all related to brand. It was our identity, our storytelling, which we did through PR, and our time with media and journalists and everything, and then our product. So we did not skimp at all when we were launching this company. And we spent $1 million before we launched, if I had to estimate, on between those three things. And that was all about getting that story right and then delivering on the promise that you said in that story, making sure it was super authentic.
On the first point, on the branding, so did you work with an agency on that? How much of it was done in-house, the branding design, that kind of stuff?
From the identity work, we worked with an agency, and that was incredibly helpful because they became an extension of our team. So we do a lot of our marketing in-house now, but our brand marketing, but you know, you have to have an extended team, and we couldn't afford to have all those genius creative people on staff from day one. So working with partners is absolutely critical in that first step, I think.
And then for the press part, how much of that was existing relationships versus you guys working with PR firms and then also like, what was the first story that really hit that came out of that?
Tim and I were not from the shoe industry. He's a professional athlete, and I was in biotech, so we had no contacts. So like we it wasn't like we were just picking up the phone with all our like close buddies at the New York Times and landing great articles. No, not at all. I mean, we just hustled. We put on events. We invited journalists. We went to their offices. We gave them shoes before we got there, had them try them on. Then we came and told the story. They're like, we've been wearing these shoes, and we love them. Like, what is the deal with this? And then, you know, the story kind of like is authentic, and it backs up why we were doing this. So, and it was just, you know, it's Tim and my stories are really intertwined with the brand in the early days, and that's going to change and evolve. And we hope to really extract ourselves from that. But, you know, particularly in the early days, it's super important to make sure that people understand to the core DNA of the company, what we stand for and why we made our decisions. So we did that, and you know, we came out, I think on the first day we launched, Time Magazine said we were the most comfortable shoe in the world. So
that's pretty incredible.
It was a great start.
It's one of these products. I remember like walking out of your office with these shoes on my feet, and I like literally put my other shoes in my car and I walked around. I was like, these are really comfortable. And I'm just thinking, if I'm a reporter, that's a very compelling experience to write about. So again, it all goes back to product excellence. I think at the end of the day, you guys built a great product from the beginning. I want to talk a little about the industry. I think when you and I first met, we talked a lot about how in the athletic shoe market, there was this consolidation, right? You had Nike and Adidas, and both companies were very focused on performance, both putting a lot of technology into their products, very complicated. Then in the casual shoe market, or in sort of the shoe you wear every day, there's just much more fragmentation, despite the fact that both markets are very similarly sized and quite large. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, why up until this point has there not been as much innovation in like, you know, actual product innovation at the shoe level in the casual market, whereas you've seen that in the performance market?
Yeah, it's a little perplexing. You know, I think in general, in the casual shoe space, the most important attribute by far is comfort. And you say comfort, like picture yourself walking in a shoe store and you go up and you ask the sales associate for a comfortable shoe. Like you expect a beast with horns to come out of the back. It's hard to make comfort aspirational. And our view has been that it is so important, and there really is room for something to be aspirational there. And it's got to be playful, and it's got to have great personality, and it's got to be innovative. It's got to be with new materials. But I do think, you know, if you look at casual shoes and the dynamics of the industry, it's been kind of a silhouette and a material combination that is usually pretty divisive from a design perspective. So it's something very unique looking, and it catches your eye so that people are like, what is that? And you either like it or you hate it. And, right. and, you know, I think there's examples of this like UGG and Crocs and, mm-hmm. you know, a number of examples where those have really taken off, but it's really been like this one item. And it doesn't extend to a more broad-based assortment or a brand that really stands for something mm-hmm. across casual shoes. And so you have these little niches where, you know, there's a skate shoe and there's a, you know, a big boot with UGG, and there's other companies that do, they have really owned great businesses that end up being pretty large, but they never transcend the category of casual shoes like the big athletic companies have in performance.
Right.
And so we think there's a great opportunity to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it seems, speaking of those two, UGG and Crocs specifically, I mean, both very fast growing businesses initially, but they weren't able to really bridge into something that was like more mainstream or is in some ways the thing that makes you successful in those businesses is what ultimately does you in, because it's how iconic that Croc is not going to be something that, you know, a lot of people are going to want to wear. You guys, from a product development standpoint, seem to have taken, I think, more of a middle road. Like, have you thought about going more extreme on some of the products, or?
No, I mean, it's a pointed observation that you make. I mean, yeah. we think about our design process by taking a classic silhouette mm-hmm. and stripping away absolutely everything that's not functionally required. And that simplification process is very challenging. And you have nowhere to hide when you make a shoe this simple. So it makes the manufacturing quality such a hard thing to get right. And it's been very difficult for us. And we spend dozens and dozens of prototypes and many, many months spending time with our factories and our development partners and our internal teams doing work to get this thing right before we launch a shoe. And I think, you know, one of the big differences for us is we take that classic silhouette and we strip it away and make it beautiful through simplicity. It's really hard. It's kind of like Dieter Rohm's principles of design. And that's the way we think about design. We also think about the fact that comfort is different for different experiences and different parts of your day, different seasons, different climates, different places, whatever, different activities. And so how do we bring a material and a design together in a way that celebrates whatever you're doing and makes it comfortable for whatever you're doing? So we think of ourselves much more of a material innovation company, mm-hmm. and we're delivering amazing materials that happen to be very, very sustainable and great for the planet.
As an illustration of that, I was wondering, because you guys just launched the eucalyptus-based shoes, like they're called tree runners?
Yep. Tree runners,
maybe
tree skippers.
As an example, talk a little bit about how you guys decided to work on that material and what you were able to do with it that people weren't able to kind of do before.
Yeah, I mean, it starts with a consumer problem. So we knew we wanted kind of utility across a bunch of different activities. You needed to be wearing it in the daytime at work, at night at dinner, at whatever else you're doing on the weekends. And we wanted it to be a little bit cooler. So we knew that wool wasn't going to be perfect for all year round. If it's really hot and muggy, we found out that 2/3 of people don't wear socks in the summer with our shoes. So it can get a tiny bit hot, even though it's a really breathable fabric. There's times. And so we're like, okay, we need a fiber that can really deliver a cooling sensation. And we researched it and we found, because we constrain it to natural materials or naturally derived materials, that we found that eucalyptus pulp has this really silky soft feel to it when you touch your foot or your hand against it, and it has a cooling sensation. And so that sent us down this rabbit hole of developing a line around trees. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking at different manufacturing techniques. We found out that to get the breathability and the durability we needed to use a particular kind of knitting technology, which is software enabled. So it took us about a year to figure that thing out. Uh-huh. And we had to develop a yarn that was perfect for this process. Then we got the knitting technology correct. And then we built a couple shoes out of it. And I think there'll be a lot more to come, because it's a sensational line.
That's awesome. I think people generally just don't know how much technology goes into this stuff.
Yeah, making a shoe is hard.
Making a shoe is really hard. Oh, I want to talk a little bit about selling shoes online. If I go back 10, 15 years and you look at Zappos, and you know, one of the original innovations in the way they sold shoes was they sort of baked in the idea that people would return them into the business model. And they said, it's okay if people return the shoes, or it's okay if people call customer service. We're going to make our customer service so great that people are going to rave about it, and we'll let them return it within 12 months. So they almost trained customers of shoes online to expect a high return rate, which is not great for every other business, especially the brands. So when you guys approach selling footwear online, considering that, you know, no one's worn wool shoes before, like how are you able to get people over that hump and then also just kind of tackle the returns kind of question.
Yeah, I mean, being a direct-to-consumer business, I think people forget that you've taken on two challenges. You've taken on the challenge of the best product brands in the world, and you've taken on the challenge of the best retailers of the world. So you need to be as good as Nordstrom and Zappos are for retail on shoes. You need to be as good as Nike has been for producing product for decades. That's a big challenge to tackle. Fortunately, technology is kind of accelerated and allowed us to use tools that make that a little bit easier to reach consumers and give good service. You know, but we also looked at we looked at some data, and the market data says that 83% of transactions for shoes in America are still offline. So they're done in stores. 17% is online. And most of that 17% is people that are like, I know what size, I know what brand. It's just a replenishment purchase. Right. So I think what has happened in retail is that And you know, we think physical stores are super important. It's a big part of our strategy for this reason. And we knew it really early on, is that there's been this change where e-commerce has changed the way people buy, but people still like to buy and prefer to buy things that are tactile and have fit issues in stores. So they like that experience. And that's pretty clear from the data, and it varies from region to region. But, you know, So the experience needs to be, you need to do something a little bit unique to get people over the hump of understanding that it's going to be a good buying experience. Don't worry. So we introduced a 30-day wear in the wild policy where people could buy the shoes, wear them outside. And we were kind of convinced that we made something unique enough and exciting enough for people that they wouldn't return it. And fortunately, that's largely been the case. And that's really worked out well for us. So we really pushed people to take every friction out of the buying process that we could, because we knew we couldn't be in every department store, because that would be kind of a losing strategy given what's happened in the world today.
Given the fact that it's made of wool and it has some flex to it, does that help you with some of the fit?
For sure.
I mean, that was my experience was like, I'm between a 10 and a 10 and a half, but I don't know which ones I got, but they fit me instantly. And I've never had a fit problem. And maybe that's because I know my size really well, but it feels like that's an advantage you guys have.
Well, we have some shoe dogs in the building that know how to make shoes that fit really, really well. So not to take anything away from our team, but the flexibility of the fabrics that we use is also pretty, pretty helpful.
Yeah.
We do only whole sizes. So that's another thing that
sure.
You could arguably increase your return rate. We think it's actually done the opposite, because we have a flexible shoe that you can really get away with being a 10 or 11 probably, and you'd be fine.
Exactly. And you mentioned retail. I wanted to go and talk a little bit more about your retail strategy, because you guys launched retail a lot earlier than most digital brands that we've worked with. I don't know how long it took Andy at Bonobos to do it, but I'm sure it wasn't until year 4 or 5 at least. You guys did it within the first year. So when you were evaluating different models, whether it was sort of the guide shop concept or sort of just everything from guide shops to a full store to pop-ins to pop-ups, like, how did you make the decision to do what you do? And what's been sort of the things that have worked and things that have been challenging?
Well, it goes back to that bit of data where, only 17% of transactions are done online. So we knew that people still like to buy shoes in stores. We're a material innovation company. We're a tactile experience where you need to touch and feel this stuff. And if you put your hand in a bowl of this eucalyptus pulp that we use, that after it's turned into fiber, it's an unbelievable feeling. And so you got to touch and feel that stuff. We make our own furniture. We design our own furniture in our stores, and we make it a great try-on experience for how the furniture is designed. And we also wrap it in our fabrics, and we make sure that the materiality comes through in every bit of the buying experience. We think it's probably a better experience is to be in our store and learn about the brand and understand exactly what we're about. And of course, there's another effect that has been very well proven in direct-to-consumer businesses that have tried offline stores, physical brick-and-mortar stores, is that when people are walking by, it's like a great billboard. So your brand is exposed to thousands or millions of people, depending on where you're at. And then your e-commerce business actually succeeds and thrives because of that kind of multi-marketing touch in that region. And you end up getting this virtuous cycle where the offline actually helps the online. And it's really hard to see that effect at a user level, but you can see the lift in a region pretty clearly.
Do you think of it mostly as a customer acquisition vehicle, and replenishment is online, or are you finding people replenishing in store as well?
It's both. Yeah, no, it's not just an acquisition vehicle. Huh. You know, first of all, we don't do the guide shop model.
Like yeah.
People, we can't even give people boxes. They just want to walk out with the shoes.
Yeah. So for our listeners, a guide shop is basically a store with no inventory. So you sort of select it, but then you get it delivered via the online channel. You guys have inventory in store.
We do. We've done a lot of innovations in design to make sure that our inventory can be as in stock as we possibly can. I've talked to some very wise old shoe dogs, and I've always asked them, what if you could start a shoe store, what would be the top problems you'd solve? And I remember one person answered, the top 25 problems are just to be in stock in all styles. Hmm. Forget about anything else related to technology, just be in stock. Hmm. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And so having inventory and letting people have a quick experience when they ask for a size, that it comes right to them,
right.
And that you have enough in stock, is something that's absolutely critical for our business.
Yeah.
It puts a big burden on us, but we think it's an amazing experience. Then those people can just shop online later, or when we have new stuff and new materials and they want to do it again, they might come back in, and they love our sales associates. And,
yeah. Well, selfishly, right? It's the quicker you get that shoe from the back room to the floor, the faster that customer purchases and they move on, and you have now room for a new customer in the store.
Yeah.
So that velocity is super important. I know your store here in San Francisco is always busy.
Our prices are really low. So yeah. It's not like we're, you know, we think we've taken, you know, in the case of merino wool, we've taken fibers that are used in $5,000 suits and we've packed it into a $95 shoe. To make a store successful, you generally need a reasonable volume going through. So
right.
It exacerbates that issue with making sure you have enough inventory. And it's a hard problem. We're learning. We're so young and we're just kind of figuring it out still.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of up level a little bit to more talking about just e-commerce more generally, because I generally have one of two conversations with people about e-commerce. There's people who are super, super bearish because they see how dominant Amazon is, and the logical path I think goes through is that must be bad for everyone else. I'm on the other side of that. I suspect you are as well. I actually think it's the most exciting time to be involved in e-commerce. But that being said, how do you view kind of Amazon's role in the changing e-commerce ecosystem? And in particular, what is it doing into the fashion and apparel and accessories space? You know, for example, they have, I think, about 70 private label brands right now. Most of those are fashion brands. How do you view their role in that part of the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think they're kind of like our best friend and our biggest enemy. You know, Amazon's job, I think, in general, could be summed up as commoditizing brands. I mean, they're trying to devolve everything down to feature, benefit, and price. And that's the way that they win their customers' hearts, and then they deliver products really fast to your door at the best prices. And so, you know, it's a great business model. And I think what that has done, so they're like 8% of retail. But they have affected 100% of retail. So the effect of Amazon on Nordstrom and on Macy's, and I mean, you can see it in the news every day. And what the problem is that everyone is competing for the same customer. And if everyone has perfect information, which everyone does now, you go online and you say you want a pair of whatever, name your favorite brand, sneaker, and you'll get people bidding on that search term on Google from 20 different companies. And you get served Facebook ads from 20 different companies for that one brand. And so if you allow your product to be over-distributed in multi-channel distribution, you've just increased the cost it's going to take for you to acquire a customer. And so the omni-channel game has become very, very challenging unless you have a model where you're very fast on your SKU, on how fast you change styles and,
yeah.
and things like that.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying, the first point you made was just that Amazon is battling the notion of aspirational brands. Like Amazon would prefer a world where there are no aspirational brands, where there is no willingness to pay for something that's different, where there's a promise of something. Does that mean startups shouldn't sell their products on Amazon?
It depends. I mean, look, it depends. If that's the only place that they can get it, it depends what the value proposition in the long run for that business is. If it's something where it's like an amazing bit of technology that's patent protected and you know that no one can replicate it, then sure, get it out there.
Yeah.
Like sell it in a bunch of places and never discount it and let it roll. But you know, for us, it's about brand. We don't do a lot of style changes. We consistently upgrade. We never discount our product. And so if you're trying to control your merchandise and control your price, and make sure that you don't break a contract that you have with your consumer, which is when you buy it from us at full price, like we're not going to go discount it 3 months later and sell it, or you can't find it on the internet 2 months later at, you know, 30% off because someone can't get rid of your inventory.
Right.
Like, that's just not something we're going to do because we don't want to break that contract. So in one way, I mean, Amazon has basically, what I was concluding was that Amazon has created the opportunity for us.
Yeah.
To sell direct, because they have really created headwinds for every other shoe brand. So every single shoe brand in the world is led by wholesale distribution of any material size. You know, that's created a really interesting opportunity for us to do that, because it puts pressure on those brands to get faster, cheaper, and then you start to do less innovation and you start to focus more on cost reduction as your innovation.
The side effect of Amazon's success online is that the sort of channels that are traditionally like commoditized wholesale channels, like department stores and some of these big mass category stores, maybe like a Foot Locker, they're just suffering. And because they're suffering, consumers are not going to go in there and spend time looking for new brands. They're going to go online. And so you get the benefit of that open space in the market. So that's at least how we look at it. That's one of the reasons we're so excited.
And one of your previous guests, Andy Dunn, wrote a great piece on having proprietary merchandise and using that as the lever to win in e-commerce. And in the world of, you know, post-Amazon world, like having your own product that you manufacture and distribute exclusively through your own channel, people, if they like the product, they're going to come and get it.
Well, so that I was glad you brought that up, because I was going to talk to you about that strategy. Obviously, like, you know, we were investing in Bonobos. Walmart now owns Bonobos. They've acquired a number of other digital brands, and they have this sort of flagship brand strategy where they want these flagship brands that will draw people into the stores because you can only get them at Walmart. I mean, it's a very different strategy than Amazon. While they have private label, they're not necessarily trying to build a huge halo around those private labels. So, I mean, do you think that strategy is going to work and scale for Walmart and sort of make it effective against Amazon, or do you think they're just fighting different battles?
It's interesting. You know, I've listened to Mark Lorry, who runs Walmart.com and Jet.com, talk about this, and you know, I think they understand that the differentiator is to have great merchandise and great experiences for the customers to come, to keep having customers come back and grow loyalty to their platform. So I think they're, you know, I don't know if they need to go buying a bunch of businesses, but I'll leave that for them to decide. But the idea of having relationships with direct to consumer businesses, which only offer their products through Jet.com or Walmart.com, I think that's a cool strategy for them. And I think it could be good for some brands that want to do unique and exclusive partnerships with companies like that. If they've been successful in engaging consumers in a special way, and particularly if they engage a particular set of consumer who have, you know, brand affinity and brand loyalty, it's an interesting strategy. It's to be clear, it's not something that we're doing, and it's not, I don't think it's right for our business per se, but yeah. I think it's an interesting place that they've tried to carve out.
Speaking of sort of these leading digital brands, you guys being in that category, are there other companies that are digitally defined that you guys look to that you think are doing interesting things that you've kind of incorporated into your business?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. There's no like perfect single silver bullet, but we've taken some nuggets, some great nuggets from a bunch of different places. So I think businesses like Warby Parker have done a wonderful job of creating a brand experience around a product, and they've done it in a way that's been exceptional both online and offline. Mm-hmm. And their stores are beautiful. They do a great job with a seamless buying experience offline and online. I think that's been really fantastic, and we take a lot of pages out of their playbook for that. Businesses like Casper have done a great job of curating a problem and saying, okay, there's this paradox of choice in the mattress business. So what do you do? Let's just give them one mattress. That's what they want. I think we apply that thinking to shoes too. It's like, well, you could get sneakers with lots of fancy stuff and lots of bells and whistles, but if you boil it down to its most simple functional form, and you focus on comfort, what people want, what's the single best sneaker we could possibly make? That was the challenge we set out and we embarked on when we started. So we took cues from that. I think there's some companies like Universal Standard is a really young company that focuses on plus size women's apparel. Mm-hmm. And they do some really fascinating stuff with sizing and staying with women. If their size changes over a certain period of time, there's something called the universal fit standard where you can kind of just return it and get the new size. So you don't have to worry about your body shape and your identity as it evolves and how that fits with the piece of apparel you bought. I think there's, you know, Glossier does a wonderful job with community building. And there's a ton of different companies that we just look for lots of amazing lessons. And we're not shy about saying that we definitely don't know the answers. And we look to people who've done amazing things. And not to say that we're copying stuff, but it's about, you know, learning from the best and then trying to incorporate it in a way that makes sense for your own business. And I think we've tried to do that all along the way.
I wanted to kind of draw it to a close by asking you to kind of maybe put yourself in a little bit of a different seat. You know, say you're one of these legacy commerce players. You're sitting in the CEO chair of like a large retailer or maybe, you know, a big brand holding company like VF Corp or The Gap. I mean, what are you thinking through right now, given the fact that you have all this knowledge of how business is being done, you know, in the latter part of the 2010s? You know, would you be taking more of a Walmart strategy in terms of the sort of the acquiring new brands, more of an Amazon private label strategy? Or if you're VF Corp or The Gap, how are you innovating on your own brands and either restructuring things you have or inventing new things?
There's some brands that are in tricky situations. You know, a lot of in the change of retail when e-commerce became made information so efficient that everyone could see everything. These brands have immediately become over-distributed and saturated in the market because you can absolutely get them anywhere. And I think if I was sitting in the chair, CPG brands for fashion, apparel, or footwear, I would be very open-minded to trying to understand what a data-rich company is and trying to understand what a company that's direct-to-consumer, what the benefits, the true benefits of that are. And without having any reliance on wholesale for us, it means that if we put a dollar in one marketing channel, we know exactly what comes out. And we know exactly what the return on that is, offline and online. We can understand our customer really intimately. We understand exactly what they do because we understand every time they interact with our brand. So we see the customer journey and we learn an incredible amount, and we get to apply that right back into our products, into our marketing messages, and into everything else that we do as a business. So we basically have focused and turned our entire business to listen to our customer. And then we take that and we actively listen, and then we apply changes into our business, into every facet of our business. I think big companies often talk about that they're data rich and they're using big data and whatnot. But I think it's not really possible for them to actually utilize data because there's so much noise and there's so much data that they actually don't have access to because it's their retail partners that have that data. Right. It's the multi-touch marketing done from lots of other places and lots of other distortions in the market that they just can't see. So I think I'd be a little scared about what's happening in the world of direct to consumer if I was a holding company or if I was a big brand, and I would be really thinking hard about how to develop a channel so that you can uniquely understand what a direct-to-consumer data-rich environment does for your business and how fast you can react and how much better you can build a business and how much healthier it can be given the set of modern circumstances that we find ourselves in with technology.
That's a great way to close it, because I think it's absolutely correct. It's a really hard thing to do to operate two different channels to market. People are going to have to figure out how to do it, because that data on your customer, everyone prefers to be customer, you know, they'll say we are so customer focused, but that direct relationship that you have enables you to get longitudinal data on an individual.
Yeah.
And that's
totally
something that's
level.
Impossible to do through wholesale.
Yeah.
So, well, good. Well, Joey, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed the chat. I'm sure our listeners have as well. And I am going to go off to the store and get myself some of those eucalyptus.
Please, please buy a lot. It's good. Please buy a lot. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed this show, please go to your podcast app or wherever else you find these things and subscribe to Tomorrow Built Today to hear more interviews and conversations like these. Thanks, and talk to you soon.
This podcast is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. For more details on this episode, head over to tbtpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.